Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Norman Swan and you're listening to The Health Report. In this program, a special feature on movement and how to make it work better. And I'm talking about your muscles, not your bowels. Better ways of getting better after a stroke and how to reverse aging in your muscles. Hoover out the old ones, refresh them so they look just like new, and you can do it without drugs. And if you are into drugs, evidence for a performance-enhancing substance that might get you off your mark faster, whether you're off to Beijing or not. The person doing a lot of this work is Mark Tarnopolsky, who's Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at McMaster University in Canada. A children's doctor looking after older people? How come?
That's an interesting question. I actually trained initially as an adult physician, and my main area of specialty are mitochondrial disorders. But we now know that many of the mitochondrial disorders are present in young children. So
mitochondria, these are the energy-producing bits of the cell that sit in the soup of the cell and have their own genetic structure.
That's correct. So the mitochondria are very analogous to a furnace. So in the way in which we burn natural gas and oxygen to create energy, the mitochondria are present in essentially every cell in our body and mix the food that we eat with the oxygen we breathe and create energy.
And some people think that they're at the heart of the aging process.
Yes, that's a long-held thought, that the mitochondria are essential to aging, and mitochondrial dysfunction or accumulated damage to the mitochondria is a component of the aging process.
The theory is that side products of making energy from food, called free radicals, are needed to send messages inside cells. But when there are too many free radicals, they cause damage to the mitochondria, damage that has a flow-on effect to the body, which we call aging. And since aging muscles are what often debilitates people the most as the years pass, it's important to understand what's going on in mitochondria, because as you'll hear, they're unlocking very practical ways of rejuvenating ourselves. And a lot of this has been learned from rare diseases of mitochondria and muscles. Mark Tarnopolsky again.
It's estimated now that about 1 in 6,000 people have a mitochondrial disease. In children, they present usually with failure to thrive, developmental delay, seizures, or sometimes cardiac hypertrophy, where the heart gets enlarged and they have failure to pump. In adults, the most common ones that we see are related to a seizure thing called Milas syndrome, where people have stroke-like episodes, visual loss, hearing loss, droopy eyelids, and muscle weakness are all things that we see in adults who have these mitochondrial disorders.
You believe that by looking at elderly people, you can also learn about what's going on with mitochondria, not that they have necessarily a mitochondrial illness.
Right. With aging, every human being in the world has a mitochondrial disease. All of us have mitochondria. They're all getting older and accumulating mutations. And what we found is some of the hallmarks that we look for in children and young adults with mitochondrial disease are interestingly present not only in our children with disease, but also in the aging process. So in an older muscle, we find many of the same muscle characteristics that we see in children with disease.
To test this idea, a group of researchers did a fascinating study in mice. The scientists disabled genes in the mice in a way which damaged the ability of their mitochondria to repair themselves. The result was old mice.
So what they found then in the mice is they developed graying of their hair, atrophy of the testicles and sex organs in females, kyphoscoliosis, which is very commonly seen with osteoporosis, where they get the Dower's hump, thinning of the muscles, which is really one of the most important healthcare concerns with aging, is that if you get very thin muscle, sometimes called sarcopenia, that can lead to inability to get out of a chair, to care for yourself, and eventually institutionalization because of the sarcopenia process. And so they could recapitulate that by damaging the mitochondrial DNA, showing that mitochondria do have a role in aging.
And you've been on a mission to see whether you can resuscitate the mitochondria.
About 12 years ago, people stumbled onto a serendipitous observation. When they did muscle biopsies from patients who developed sporadic mitochondrial disease. So what happened is one of my colleagues simultaneously in Montreal and also in England did is when they did a muscle biopsy and they took the biopsy and put it in culture, what happens is that all the mature muscle fibers die and then there's a stem cell precursor called a satellite cell, which represents about 2 to 4% of the muscle nuclei that are present. They start to grow and form a myoblast.
So this is the process of producing new muscle.
Correct. So what the two folks were hoping for is that they could then use this cell culture technique to study the biology of mitochondrial disease. But to their surprise, what they found is that when they grew up the new muscle fibers, they were completely normal. So in the mature muscle, when they did a muscle biopsy, there were deletions of the mitochondrial DNA, there was dysfunction, there was decrease in enzyme activity.
So they rebooted the muscle in a sense.
Exactly.
Inadvertently, these researchers had renewed the muscle and purged it of the prematurely stuffed mitochondria. Somehow these satellite cells, the ones which were a bit like muscle stem cells, had remained aloof from the aging process, and when given their head, so to speak, regenerated normal muscle containing young mitochondria. And what seemed to have made this happen was the stress and injury caused by the muscle biopsy in the laboratory testing. Mark Tarnopolsky.
So when I heard this, I was immediately interested in exercise as a more acceptable way of damaging the muscle, and one that older adults may take advantage of. So we've done some experiments which we can talk about.
In other words, in some way, by damaging the muscle, you revive the mitochondria.
Correct. So what we've done is we've actually done muscle biopsies from young people and old people, and we look in the mature muscle and the satellite cells. In the mature muscle, what we find is with aging, there is a reduction in mitochondrial enzyme activity. There's an increase in damage to the mitochondrial DNA. So we see things called deletions. We see an increase in oxidative stress. And when we do the myoblast cultures from the satellite cells, we see none of this. So the older adult satellite cell seems to have a very young phenotype, and it has no deletions, no damage. So our theory was that if we exercise people,
they had the raw material to be able to produce decent muscle.
Exactly. And we could bring in the good mitochondria, remove the old mitochondria because of the damage of exercise, and in a sense shift down the bad mitochondria, or shift them out. And get
so what did you do?
So we trained older adults for 6 months, twice a week for an hour.
What sort of training?
It was weight training, because with weight training, you tend to get more damage to the muscle. And the key here, what we feel, is that you actually have to activate the satellite cells to get the benefit.
So of course, this is what muscle builders and people who want to buff their body have known for years, is that you've actually got to go over the hill to actually tear muscle fibers in order to build muscle.
Essentially, that's true. I mean, there may be, you may not have to cause frank damage. It may just be a high degree of strain. But we do know that if you do, for example, marathon running, you're lean and you don't get muscle hypertrophy. The only way to get hypertrophy is to do a fairly high percentage of your maximum and doing few repetitions. For example, what we would say is the one repetition maximum is your maximal. If you drop that to 70% and you do that 10 or 15 times with three sets, that would be a typical set, which would induce muscle hypertrophy.
Now, if you're not a gym junkie, you probably haven't a clue what Mark's talking about. The idea is that you find out the maximum weight you can manage for one single movement. It's called a repetition. So if it's your biceps, it'd be lifting the weight with your hand towards you. Once you know what your maximal weight is, you'd then drop down to about two-thirds of that weight or less for your actual training. The training usually involves three rounds of 10 or so repetitions of that exercise. So if you can manage 5 kilos just once, you'd probably start training on 2 or 3 kilogram weights, then work up.
So we set out to do that in old people, and we showed, as folks have known since the 70s, that there's an increase in strength and function in the older adults.
And work in Tufts and Boston showed that in the extreme elderly in nursing homes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, even folks into their 80s and 90s. And what we found is that after the 6 months of training, there actually is an increase in mitochondrial enzyme activity, which doesn't happen in young people. These people were fairly active, walking their dog, playing tennis, and doing recreational activity. Clearly, the weight training was more than what they normally did, but it was no different than what activity our younger people had been doing when we've done weight training. And yet, with young people, we never see an increase in mitochondrial activity. But if you think about it, they have healthy, mature muscle fibers with normal mitochondria. So when you do weight training, you just get a shifting of good to good. What's cool about the older adults is that you've got
the garbage disposal.
Right. So there's a process called autophagy, which removes the old damaged mitochondria. The new ones come in from these relatively quiescent satellite cells, and bang, we get an increase in mitochondrial function.
Was this progressive training? In other words, you kept on building them up. Once they got good at one weight, you moved them on to the next, so it was hard work?
There are people who believe that it's impossible to weight train older adults, and I've actually been challenged at conferences saying that you can't weight train older adults because they'll cause damage. I think that's complete bollocks. So what we did, and I do agree that you have to start a little lower. So we started at 50% of their one repetition maximum and then build up to 65 and eventually closer to 70%. Whereas with younger people, we can usually start at 60 or 65% and go up to 80 or 85%. And it's probably more of a joint issue with the older adults that you start to get tendonitis and various joint problems.
And did you find that they got over the hump? In other words, in theory, if you've got the garbage disposal unit working, you're clearing out all the old crap, basically, and you've got this new muscle, did all of a sudden they jump over the fence and it became easier?
Anyone who does exercise notices that it becomes easier. And a lot of these were anecdotes. I mean, we do all of our biochemical and more objective outcomes. But we had some very interesting anecdotes where people were coming in saying they couldn't pick up their grandson or their granddaughter. And after the weight training, they could do that. They could carry all of their shopping bags in instead of making 3 and 4 trips. They could go up and down stairs more easily. There's no question that the weight training in older adults does really improve function. And ultimately, that's what we care about from a healthcare perspective. Can we decrease disability, keep people independent in their homes, and prevent them from having to go and require assistive devices and alternative health care?
Tell me about the creatine study, which is one of these controversial but legal performance-enhancing drugs.
The main controversy behind creatine is the controversy that surrounds all ergogenic aids.
And by ergogenic, you mean the ability to produce more energy?
Yeah, ergogenic work-enhancing is really technically what ergogenic means. Now, there are legal and illegal forms of ergogenic substances. For example, exercise could be considered ergogenic. Carbohydrate loading, taking in extra carbohydrates, is an ergogenic process. Caffeine, that's where you start to blur the, you know, doping versus ergogenic aid, because caffeine can be processed as a chemical, but it can also be part of a food substance. And therefore, the IOC had a big problem with caffeine because, you know, how do you tell someone they can't have their morning espresso when that still could give them 100 or 150 milligrams of caffeine and start to raise the level? And people have clearly shown, actually, Louise Burke in Australia has done some beautiful work showing that even fairly low doses of caffeine can be ergogenic or enhance performance at doses which could be found in one cup of coffee. So the IOC previously had a ban on it, now they don't. Creatine, you could also get, and you could clearly creatine load if you ate about 1.1 kilo of meat every day. And that's not crazy for a top sport power lifter or sprinter to eat that much meat.
So what is it? A raw material for muscle or what?
Creatine is actually synthesized in our liver, kidneys as well, and a little bit in the pancreas every day. So about 1 gram to 1.5 grams of creatine is made every single day by the normal human body process. Creatine is also found in meat and fish, especially cold water fish. It has very high concentration of creatine, as well as omega-3s and other good things. And we get about 1 gram to 1.5 grams of creatine in a typical North American diet. So together, that's about 2.5 to 3 grams of creatine that our muscles, brain, and heart are seeing every day. Almost every tissue in the body contains creatine and is transported from the blood into the tissues with a transporter. And in muscle, it was traditionally thought that what creatine did predominantly was to make phosphocreatine, which is a buffer of energy. So when you start running up a flight of stairs and ATP is broken down,
that's one of the energy substances in the body.
Correct. That's the energy currency of the body. So when ATP gets broken down and you form ADP, you have to reform ATP. So if one was doing a 100...
It's like your lithium battery.
Precisely, but it's got a short half-life. It'll only last for about 8 to 9 seconds. So that gives people that buffer for the first sort of 8 to 9 seconds. As a consequence, people were very interested from the sporting arena to try and improve performance in sprinting. So people that are doing a 100-meter sprint, which, you know, is taking 9.5 to 10 seconds, is creatine going to improve performance? And although it's never been proven with a 100-meter sprint, it was estimated, I believe, at the 1988 Olympics that everyone on the starting line for the final of the 100 meters was creatine loaded. And in the laboratory, if you give young, healthy people creatine, it improves performance in repetitive sprint activity by about 1 to 1.4%. But if you think about first to eighth in a 100-meter sprint, it's far less than 1% at the time. So many athletes were taking it as an ergogenic aid in power and sprinting type of activity. Just because of my area of research, I'm obviously less interested in that aspect. But we immediately said, well, this is an interesting compound for the athletes, but I wonder if it would help our patients. So the first thing that we did is we did muscle biopsies from people with different types of neurologic disease. And we found that people with muscular dystrophy and mitochondrial diseases had low creatine in their muscle. So we thought that if the creatine's low, it probably would make sense at least to bring them up to a normal level. And could that creatine deficiency actually cause problems? We've now found that there are creatine deficiency syndromes. So they're genetic diseases where people can't transport creatine into muscle and brain. And these are very serious. Children have seizures, developmental delay. So it clearly shows that creatine is important for brain and also for muscle, and deficiency is not well tolerated.
But in some of those situations, supplementation wouldn't help if you can't get the creatine inside.
Correct. So there's two types. One is the synthesis defect, where creatine supplementation is quite helpful. One is the transport defect, where people are looking at trying to get around the mutant transporter by giving inordinately high levels of creatine without, I hasten to add, much success. But in the case of aging, muscular dystrophy, and mitochondrial disease, you have a muscle that's having a little bit more difficulty bringing creatine in, but still it can transport creatine. So we did a study with Duchenne muscular dystrophy boys where we gave them creatine for 4 months or placebo. As we were doing it, a group in Belgium published a smaller study showing quite substantial benefits, some so remarkable I almost didn't believe them. But when we published our data and analyzed it, we did find an increase in strength, an increase in muscle mass, and some markers of function actually were better when the boys were on creatine. Subsequently, a thing called a Cochrane review, which is a meta-analysis, looked at creatine in muscle disease because there was another big study done in Germany. And the net result was an improvement in function in muscular dystrophy.
Which is remarkable, since there's not much else that helps these kids who are really on a downward spiral.
Well, the interesting thing with Duchenne dystrophy is the only drug available is prednisone or deflazacort. These are corticosteroids, which have inordinate side effects, just unbelievable. I mean, I had a child in yesterday who developed severe diabetes, and we had to pull him off of it after being on prednisone for just a couple of months. Cataracts, osteoporosis, the list goes on. And the improvement in strength is only about 4 to 6%. And yet, over a long period of time, that keeps a boy out of a wheelchair by around about 2 years. Whereas with creatine, we were finding a 9 to 11% increase in strength. And we were seeing this in boys who were on steroids and boys who weren't. So one, it's a nice alternative for those who can't tolerate the steroid side effects. And two, even those on steroids gives them an extra boost.
And you've tried it in the elderly?
We've tried it in the elderly, and just one thing to follow up on that is we also tried it in rats to see if some of the side effects of steroids could be prevented. Because in most of our patients with acquired neuromuscular disease, we use steroids as a treatment, and as you know, it's used for asthma and various other things. And people get muscle weakness and bone loss. And what we found in growing rats, if we treated them simultaneously with creatine, we could prevent many of the bone-related side effects. We could allow them to grow normally instead of having the stunted growth, and we showed improvements in their muscle mass. So there may be other benefits to boys and others on steroids by taking the creatine in terms of preventing side effects. And that's been borne out in a clinical study with polymyositis and dermatomyositis, which are inflammatory muscle diseases. And those folks did show improvement in function when they took the creatine, all of whom were on steroids.
And your trial in the elderly?
We've done two trials. One was published in 2003, where we had older adult men and women train for 4 months, 3 times a week, lifting weights. And what we found is that everybody improved strength, everybody improved muscle mass, and everybody improved function. But the strength increases and the fat-free mass, which is essentially your muscle mass, improvements were greater for those who trained with creatine. And this was a fairly low dose. It was only 5 grams per day, which, you know, is not a lot more than what our muscles are seeing every day just from our normal diet. And we did prove as well with muscle biopsies that we could increase the creatine level in older adult muscle, and it did stay elevated for that time. More recently, we've come back and we've done more molecular work, which we haven't published all of it yet, where we trained people for 6 months, twice a week for an hour, and we found the same thing. Essentially, you could complete more repetitions with creatine. There was greater muscle mass gain, almost 2 kilograms more in those that trained with creatine, and strength was also up as well.
And maintained off creatine?
Yeah, we haven't published all that data yet, so I can't talk too much about it. But if I had to put a hierarchy, I'd say weight training is by far and away, and endurance exercise, I hasten to add, although we didn't do this study, but others have. Weight training, endurance training, number one. Creatine with that is a distant second, but, you know, when every little bit helps, it's a reasonable adjunct. Creatine on its own in a healthy older adult may have some beneficial effects, which we could get into, but it's probably not nearly as effective as used in combination with physical activity.
And side effects?
We very carefully check for side effects and screen a number of different tissues. For example, liver function tests, kidney function. We measure what's called creatinine clearance, and we found no side effects on any of the blood markers, and many, many other studies have been published showing that as well. The main side effect that we see are stomach cramps, and no question, reproducibly in Duchenne dystrophy, in my patients in the clinic, in our mitochondrial disease trials, and in older adults and younger adults, about 5% of the people will get stomach cramps, sometimes diarrhea and tummy upset. Usually better if they drop the dose by 50%.
Is there any difference between men and women in your studies, the elderly men and the elderly women?
We haven't found any difference with respect to strength gain or muscle mass gain in the older adults doing weight training. Part of that may be due to the fact that they're all postmenopausal and nobody takes hormone replacement therapy anymore. And we think that estrogen is probably a very important factor in what we've seen in young people, that estrogen is involved in differentiating the fuel use that someone uses during endurance exercise.
What happens?
People have known for at least 30 years that if you take a male rat and run it on the treadmill with and without estrogen, those that are treated with estrogen can run further. They tend to utilize more fat and less carbohydrate. So we were intrigued by that work, which was predominantly by a fellow named Kendrick, Zebulon Kendrick, and we wondered if that was the case with humans. So we very carefully matched young men and young women based on their dietary intake, their training history, and put them on a treadmill and bikes, and we've done this at least 15 studies now. And almost without exception, women exposed to the exact same physical stress will oxidize more lipid, less carbohydrate, and less protein, very similar to what the animal studies have shown.
Oxidizing lipid has a bad connotation because that's the process that leads to atherosclerosis inside arteries. What are you talking about?
You're talking about oxidized LDL. What I'm talking about is oxidation or utilization of the lipid.
So it's a burn.
It's burning. And in fact, elevated levels of the ability to oxidize lipid is advantageous metabolically.
In what way?
You're removing some of the lipid. And well, let me take a step back. We now know that there is a link between excessive lipid accumulation in muscle and liver. You've probably heard of the fatty liver syndrome associated with metabolic dysfunction and the propensity towards the development of type 2 diabetes. So if you can oxidize that lipid and remove it instead of allowing it to accumulate and build up these various toxic byproducts, which in turn inhibit insulin signaling, you're in a more metabolically favorable cellular environment because you're removing the bad lipids.
So what happens in men?
Well, there's no question that any person who exercises, there is an increase in fat oxidation with duration. So the longer you go, you reproducibly will see that we all start to oxidize more carbohydrate. And then the longer we go, the more we start to oxidize lipid. Number two, a highly trained endurance athlete will oxidize more lipid. And that's why we really carefully have to control for training history. Because if we have men who are better trained than the women, then they're going to be oxidizing more lipid and we won't see this sex effect.
So the fitter you are, the more benefit you gain because you've changed the way you metabolize energy.
No question. That's a very reproducible finding, is that the top sport athlete has an enhanced ability to oxidize lipid for any given exercise output. And also, the longer you go, the better. You know, if you're out for 2 hours, at the end of that 2 hours, much more of the energy you're using is coming from lipid versus carbohydrates.
Mark Tarnopolsky is Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And you're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Speaking of movement, or the lack of it, stroke is something that can hit people of all ages. And while in the past, health professionals have been very negative about stroke, that's an out-of-date attitude. With good therapy from physios and occupational therapists, people can make remarkable recoveries. But there's no cause for complacency, and Dr. Lara Boyd is searching for more effective ways to speed rehabilitation. She's a physiotherapist researcher in the Brain Research Centre at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
We have data from two very important sources that tells us that rehab works. The first is a study from back in the mid-90s that showed that in an animal model, that when a lesion was induced into the brain, if you did nothing, the area of the brain that becomes unresponsive during movement actually enlarges. However, if you go in and you actually try to rehabilitate those animals, what you show is a shrinkage of the lesion area as well as a restoration of function. So that's on the animal side, but now more recently, a large clinical trial in the United States demonstrated that a very intense bout of physical therapy and occupational therapy was able to dramatically reverse the long-term effects on both behavior and brain function in chronic stroke patients.
And that's not just on fancy laboratory measures, that's on real measures that they and their loved ones would notice?
Yes, this is a very functionally based trial. The unaffected hand is actually bound up, put into a mitt, and people are actually strongly encouraged, the word is sometimes used, forced, to use that stroke-affected hand.
Boot camp for the affected hand.
It is. It's a two-week boot camp. It's hugely intense. People undergo 60 hours of physical therapy in over a two-week period, and their good hand is constrained for about 200 more hours in addition to that, so it's very, very intense. People were able to recover huge amounts of function, and we also showed that their ability to activate their brain was greatly improved as well. The problem is that not many people can either afford the time or the money that it would cost to do 60 hours of physical therapy intervention over a two-week period. So a lot of us are now kind of trying to jump off of that and discover ways that we might show the same effect for less time and obviously less financial cost.
And that beeping that we're hearing in the background is in fact one of those techniques. It's called transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Yes, it is. That was good timing on the parts of my graduate students. So we're investigating whether or not it's helpful to use external stimulation induced by a magnetic current to actually excite parts of the brain and then pair that with rehabilitation to try to speed the course of recovery after stroke.
Have you got any results that you can talk about yet?
Those studies are still ongoing, but our preliminary data are promising.
You've also found that the sort of, I mean, what physios often do, they kind of get your arm moving in a fairly abstract way. And you've looked at whether or not there's a difference if you get it moving in an abstract way rather than, say, lifting a cup of coffee.
Yes, so we just are finishing a study where we looked at how specific your training was to the movement you're actually trying to make. So task specificity as compared to just increasing use, which a lot of physio is very generalized. We look at increasing use and just kind of getting moving again. But what we have found in our data is that the more specific the training, the more task specific the training, the better we see both behavioral recovery and resumption of normal or more normal patterns of brain activation. So the suggestion is certainly there that therapeutic approaches need to now be highly individualized for that person, for the specific tasks that they want and need to do in their daily life.
And you've been doing some fascinating work on sleep.
Yet we found that sleep had a very positive effect on motor learning in people after a stroke. And this is important because we don't see the same effect on people who are the same age, so older adults, but are healthy, who haven't had a stroke. So there seems to be something different about the stroke brain with respect to sleep.
So what did you do?
We took a group of individuals with chronic stroke.
Chronic stroke, you mean they had it a while ago?
Yes. They'd had that stroke for at least 6 months. They practiced a motor skill, one of our lab tasks that they would have never known before. We then had them either wait 12 hours while they stayed awake through the day, and then we did a second test, or we had them go home and do their normal sleep. We actually had them practice in the evening. They came back the next morning, 12 hours later, and we tested them again. For the people who actually were able to sleep in between the two sessions, we actually saw them continue to improve in the motor task overnight. We didn't see that same effect in age-matched healthy controls without a stroke. So there seemed to be something special about sleep for the stroke patient that allowed them to continue to improve. We call this offline learning. So they're learning even though they're not practicing anymore.
Why?
We're going to have to study it some more before we know.
There are other conditions where the brain becomes damaged. Multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, and even acute brain injury when you've had a car accident or banged your head severely. Does what you're doing apply to those other problems?
We think so. For example, in our group with Parkinson's disease, we're right now investigating whether or not mental imagery can help people with Parkinson's. It's very difficult for people with Parkinson's to actually move. So we want to know if just imagining movement can be a useful tool for them to help them recover.
Why would you think that?
There have been other data to suggest, for example, in elite athletes, that mental imagery is a very important piece of motor learning, a practice. So it's a way of practicing without actually moving. When we mentally rehearse an activity, our brain is active in the exact same pattern as if we were actually doing it, with the exception of the primary motor cortex. So the whole plan for movement is initiated, it's just never actually sent to the muscles.
And in people with multiple sclerosis?
There we're looking at something a little bit different. It's been conventional wisdom for a long time that people with multiple sclerosis don't benefit from exercise and should actually rest and not overstress themselves. We actually think that's probably not the wisest course. That hasn't been based on good solid evidence. So we actually are starting an exercise trial for people with multiple sclerosis to see whether or not that facilitates their recovery.
Dr. Lara Boyd has a Canada research chair in the neurobiology of motor learning in the Brain Research Centre at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Norman Swan and this has been the Health Report. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.